From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is senior VOA TV correspondent Chris Simpkins. Our special guest on this edition of the program is William Julius Wilson, a distinguished sociologist, author, and professor at Harvard University. He recently completed a residency in American law and governance at the John W. Kluge Center at the Library of Congress. He studies the effects of race and class in determining the future outcomes of men and women in America. He is the author of The Truly Disadvantaged, The Inner City, published in 1987. Former President Bill Clinton praised the book as a stunning volume on how the inner cities of our country have crumbled as work has disappeared. Professor Wilson has published numerous other works of note, such as The Declining Significance of Race, in which he argues economic class has gradually become more important than race in determining the future life outcomes of African Americans. The Kluge Chair in American Law and Governance is a distinguished senior research position in residence at the Library of Congress. It is just one of the many honors that have been bestowed upon Professor Wilson during his long and distinguished career. Professor Wilson, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, Chris Simpkins.
Thank you, Carol, for having me.
Well, Professor Wilson, I'd like you to talk about the research you've been conducting here at the Library of Congress, in which you say that economic class is gradually becoming more important than race in determining the future life outcomes of African Americans. Talk about this argument and to what extent you still continue to defend that.
Yes, I published my book, The Declining Significance of Race, in 1978. And I'm taking the opportunity here at the Kluge Center to update the book, to see the extent to which the arguments I raised in 1978 apply to the situation today. And my basic argument is that economic class has gradually become more important than race in determining a black person's life trajectory. And I also argued that the center of racial conflict has shifted from the economic sector to the socio-political order. And I examined the situation today in terms of those two main arguments. And what I emphasize is that the points that I raised in the book with respect to blacks now seem to apply to all racial and ethnic groups, that income inequality has increased across racial and ethnic groups, and class has become a very significant factor in determining life chances, not only of blacks, but of whites, of Asians, and Latinos.
Professor Wilson, could you define some of the non-racial structural forces that, in your view, perpetuate poverty?
Non-racial structural forces such as joblessness brought about by changes in the economy. You know, it's interesting. In American society, and also I assume in some other Western societies, the economy now features what social scientists call an hourglass economy. That is, you have a significant growth of jobs at the top, a growth of jobs at the bottom, and a spectacular decline of median wage jobs in the middle. And what's happening is that a lot of middle-class folks are slipping down into the lower class. A lot of lower-class folks are struggling to make ends meet because of these fundamental changes in the economy. But these are basically non-racial structural changes that have a powerful effect on the life chances not only of people of color, but also of the more disadvantaged non-people of color.
But would you also argue that these non-racial structural factors or forces disproportionately affect people of color?
Oh, yes, yes. Because, you see, people of color, as I emphasized in my book, When Work Disappears, and also in The Truly Disadvantaged and The Declining Significance of Race, blacks and other people of color are vulnerable to these economic changes. If you focus on blacks, for example, it's as if racism, having put blacks in their economic place, stepped aside to watch technology destroy that place. In other words, they become particularly vulnerable to these fundamental economic changes that are occurring. And This is not true of all blacks, as I say in my book, The Declining Significance of Race. Trained and educated blacks are moving into these opening positions at the top of the hourglass economy. But lesser educated blacks are falling further and further behind. And they're affected not only by increasing technology and automation, which rewards skilled workers and displaces low-skilled workers, but they're also affected by the growing internationalization of the economy as they compete with low-wage workers in other parts of the world, particularly third-world countries.
I'd like to turn to my colleague Chris for a question.
Over the last year, I've traveled to a lot of U.S. communities around the country, major metropolitan cities, and I've seen black sections of the town and the despair. And it looks similar to a lot of other places across the country. I was just recently in Baltimore covering some of the riots and looting that went over there. But some of the issues that were raised were income disparity. And according to the census, the median household income in Baltimore in 2013 was $60,500 for white residents and $33,600 for black residents. And you mentioned some of the places, but what impact has that had, the income disparity, on communities like Baltimore and other U.S. major metropolitan communities?
Well, if you focus on the low-income black communities of Baltimore, you see that people are struggling more today than when I began writing The Declining Significance of Race in the early 1970s. Fewer poor blacks today live next to middle-class blacks, and they are experiencing real problems in neighborhoods that are on decline, not only because of a growing joblessness in these neighborhoods, but also because of what I call a weak institutional resource base. That is the link between churches, schools, community organizations, civic clubs are weak and deteriorating. And when you have a weak institutional resource base, prostitution, gang delinquency, crime, drug activity can take root in the neighborhood. And what I would argue is that the poor neighborhoods today are worse off than they were several decades ago. And an interesting thing that I talk about in my various lectures is that there is growing, believe it or not, income segregation among blacks. That is a separation of families by income. I'm not talking about racial segregation here now. I'm talking about the differences in neighborhoods of higher income blacks from lower income blacks. Now, in 1970, black Americans had the lowest rate of income segregation. Today, black Americans have the highest rate of income segregation. That's because affluent blacks are moving into much better communities than before, whereas poor blacks are just stuck behind in highly segregated neighborhoods. Now, of course, black neighborhoods, on average, are poorer than white neighborhoods. I'm not trying to suggest that black neighborhoods are equal to white neighborhoods. All I'm trying to say is that income segregation has increased more rapidly in the black neighborhoods. But income segregation has increased across the nation. It's just not unique to blacks, but the black rate has increased more rapidly.
Can these conditions lead to social unrest?
Yes, they definitely can lead to social unrest because people sort of respond to opportunities that they face. And I am particularly concerned about the plight of low-income black males, many of whom have dropped out of high school because they can't see a close connection between schooling and post-school employment. They enter school, they may have high expectations, but they eventually get turned off because many of these schools are pretty deadening. I mean, some of these schools in the inner city are dumping grounds for some of the worst teachers. Research shows that if you really want to predict confrontations, violent reactions among police when they're dealing with these young black males, the best indicator is not racism, but what we call macho type behavior. By that I mean this masculinity threat, where people feel that their masculinity has been threatened and they respond accordingly. And this is true not only of white policemen, but black policemen as well. So it's too simplistic to say that encounters between the police and black males in particular reflect personal racism.
Professor Wilson, I'm so taken by your analysis. But let me ask you about this issue of income inequality, which is a major issue here in the United States. As you said, it's becoming worse and worse. We see members of Congress, President Obama, talking about income inequality. Both parties are decrying this phenomenon. So you're saying that there are many structural forces at play. We're seeing a loss of manufacturing bases in many of our inner cities. There's the phenomenon of globalization. But also, to what extent does racial discrimination enter into the equation or exacerbate the divide?
Well, certainly, one would be naive to say that race is no longer a factor in American life. You know, this talk about a post-racial society is silly. Race and racism continue to be important factors in American life. But we should not reduce every problem facing people of color to race and racism. That's just part of the overall problem. And what we now see is this growing inequality gripping all racial and ethnic groups. And we come to recognize that actually income inequality may turn out to be a more significant factor than race. I shouldn't say turn out to be. I would argue that it is. And income inequality is sort of reflected in so many different ways, not only in income segregation that I've talked about, but it's reflected in access to highly selective elite colleges. It's reflected in the quality of primary and secondary education in not only public schools, but private schools. It's reflected in accumulated wealth. It's even reflected in life expectancy, you see. And so income inequality is becoming a major problem in American society, and it's affecting not only blacks, but whites, Asians, and Latinos, and other groups as well.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is William Julius Wilson, distinguished sociologist, author, and professor at Harvard University. He recently finished a four-month residency at the John W. Kluge Center at the Library of Congress, where he was the chair in American Law and Governance. I'm Carol Castiel, along with senior VOA TV correspondent Chris Simpkins. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. You can also send your feedback via email to PCUSA@voanews.com. Here's a shout out to a valued, loyal listener of PCUSA and Encounter, Danson Kagire, a journalist from Rwanda. And now a question from Chris.
50 years ago, former U.S. Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, then an assistant secretary of the Labor Department, wrote a case study about the black family in which he stated that due to the failure of the family structure in the lower class, that the gap between the possibilities of blacks and other groups will persist in being unequal. 50 years later, how much meaning does his report have?
In a obituary in the New York Times, shortly after Senator Moynihan died, I was quoted as saying that the Moynihan report, the report you're talking about, was a prophetic and important document. It was prophetic because what Moynihan talked about has been borne out. A lot of the problems that he emphasized in the report, the problems of the poor black family, the problems of low-skilled black males displaced by deindustrialization, have turned out to be correct. It's an important document because it's widely cited by social scientists. I think that he was unfairly criticized in some circles when the report came out, but to repeat, it was a prophetic document.
He does make recommendations in the report which talk about trying to improve the situation by providing jobs, job programs, vocational training, education programs for the black community.
Yes.
Is this still 50 years later what the black community needs?
Yes, absolutely. And I just wish that people had listened closely to Senator Moynihan. He was right on the money. And the things that he called for, if they had been seriously considered, we wouldn't be talking about some of the problems that we see today.
Professor Wilson, you know, we've tried all kinds of things over the decades. We've had a war on poverty in the 1960s. Why does so much poverty exist in what could arguably be considered the richest country in the world?
You know, I have often maintained that when we talk about the poverty rate and changes in the poverty rate over the years, we often focus mainly on individuals. That is, we look at individual differences and individual traits. And we lose sight of some of the fundamental changes that are occurring in our society that make life difficult for those who are not prepared for these changes. And I would argue that deindustrialization, the growing internationalization of the economy, played major roles in reinforcing poverty among some segments of the population. And we should not lose sight of that. People say that we had a war on poverty and we had all of these programs, but they don't consider that the war on poverty coincided with fundamental changes in the economy, which were much more powerful forces in determining the fate of families and individuals.
Professor Wilson, you mentioned the loss of manufacturing base and obviously globalization in general. Well, I remember even in the 80s, under President Reagan, lots of privatization occurred, and people were talking about the fact that the United States has to move from being a manufacturing economy to a more service-oriented economy. But that implies also education and training commensurate with that type of economy. My question is, why hasn't that occurred in a more rapid way to keep up with these structural changes?
That's a very important question that I'd like to put to members of Congress, not only present members of Congress, but past members of Congress. Why hasn't there been a greater commitment to improving education for Americans? That's the $1 million question. But listen, you can't be pessimistic. I mean, I remain optimistic. I think that eventually our country is going to come to grips with these problems. Surely we have problems with the present political climate. And I am not naive enough to assume that we're going to have major significant changes within the immediate future, given the current political climate. I have no illusions that the things that I call for will be acted upon in a serious way within the next few years. But maybe down the road, things will change and we will have greater political will and greater political commitment to address some of the problems.
Professor Wilson, how do we go about rebuilding our cities and black neighborhoods within those cities? What type of public policies should be formulated? And as we mentioned earlier, is it time to launch a new war on poverty in these communities?
Well, I think what we have to have is a greater investment in education. We have to rescue the young people who are now entering school and are midway through completing school. I worry about their future. I think that many of these kids who are in school and will soon graduate are in danger of becoming permanent economic proletarians. So I would like to see us focus on significantly improving education. And there are different ways to do this. One of the things that I would like to see us do is have more what we call career academies in the United States. These are special programs for kids who are not necessarily going on to college, but they get training, internships, working with businesses during the summer months, and it becomes part of their training, what we call vocational training. And when they graduate, they're more easily placed in jobs. You see, in the United States, as well as in some other countries, but especially in the United States, there is a severe school to work transition problem. A lot of young people graduate from high school, and several months later, they're still hanging around the corners. They're not working. And this is especially true in poor black neighborhoods. And I would love to see us have more career academies to encourage some of these young people to work toward significant jobs once they graduate.
Would these career academies be post-high school?
The career academies are part of high schools, of programs in high schools around the country. There are a significant number of them. And the Manpower Demonstration Research Corporation, which is a research outfit that evaluates the effectiveness of programs, found that these career academies significantly improved conditions for disadvantaged students, especially black males had experienced significant increases in employment and income once they graduated from these career academies.
I'd like to talk with you a little bit about race relations and get some of your thoughts on the future of race relations in the United States. A recent poll, which was released in May of 2015, stated that 61% of Americans now say that race relations in the United States are bad, at their highest percentage since 1992, according to this poll conducted by the New York Times and CBS News. I'm wondering, what is driving this trend, and is it some of the things that you had mentioned earlier? And now it seems that opinions among white Americans has grown sharply more negative in this poll, whereas before, white Americans did not see race relations or the deterioration of race relations as a problem.
Race relations, racial attitudes, racism are products of situations. Changing situations often, economic situations, political situations, social situations. And we should always remember that. Racism is not some little demon that emerges in people simply because they are depraved. These conditions, racial conditions, attitudes, actions are products of situations. And we have to understand that. You give me the right situation, and I will produce racial tensions and conflict. You give me the right situation, and I will produce racial amity, calm, peaceful interactions between and among the races.
That reminds me of an adage saying that racism is taught.
Yes.
It's something that is actually taught and promoted, not necessarily something that comes natural. Professor Wilson, President Obama, I'd like you to talk about him and his role in highlighting inequality and talking about the structural factors that have increased this income inequality in this country. He has a couple of years left in his administration. What do you expect of him, and to what extent can he use this bully pulpit to really try to promote concrete answers or at least programs, changes that can address the problem?
You know, President Obama is a very sophisticated man, and he has an understanding of a lot of the things that I write about. He's read carefully my book, The Truly Disadvantaged. In fact, he was on a panel discussion recently in which he talked about the book. And I think that some of the things that he's emphasizing are what I and others would call for. For example, he has a program called My Brother's Keeper, which is designed to improve the conditions of young black males. He has called for more training and education for disadvantaged people of color. He has supported affirmative action. He has recognized how important it is to have adequate health care. You know, that his health care program, what they call Obamacare in the United States, the Affordable Care Act, will significantly improve the lives of poor people, including the black poor and Hispanic poor. In fact, I would argue that the black poor and Hispanic poor probably benefit disproportionately because a disproportionate number of them were without health insurance before Obamacare. It's still the case. Not all of them are covered by health insurance. They're still a disproportionate number who are without health insurance. But over the long term, Obamacare will significantly improve their health conditions.
Unless, of course, the Republican-controlled Congress tries to repeal it.
Yes, I don't think that's going to happen. I really don't.
Chris.
Oh, and I might say one other thing about Obama. You know, his stimulus package prevented conditions for poor people, prevented them from getting even worse. He set aside $80 billion in the stimulus package for poor people, including, you know, programs that would provide training, including programs that would increase medical care, food stamps, and so on. And if it had not been for the stimulus package, the poverty rate would have soared during the economic crisis of recent years.
What would be your suggestion about trying to raise money to help fund education programs, job training programs? Is there an appetite in this country for raising taxes to help fund that along with private investment money into these urban areas?
Well, you know, it would be great if we could have a public-private partnership where businesses and the government are working hand in hand to address the problem. I mentioned My Brother's Keeper. That's an example of a partnership, businesses joining with the government to try to address some of the problems of low-skilled men of color. But in the final analysis, I think what you need is someone to make effective use of the bully pulpit to really spell out the problems of the growing inequality and make people aware that our country will be much better off if we take the steps needed to address some of the problems. And some of this will call for redistribution, including increased taxes. And people just have to realize that we have to make sacrifices to make this a better country.
Do you see shifts in public opinion in that arena?
I see right now a greater awareness among the general public that there's growing inequality. I don't see an indication now that they support a redistribution of resources like increased taxes and so on, particularly for the more wealthy individuals. But I think that that will come again if we have effective political leadership that spells out a way to address the problems in a way, and I would say a progressive way to address the problems in a way that will resonate with the American people.
And speaking of political leadership, Professor Wilson, are you optimistic that we will see that? And to what extent is there a divide between Democrats and Republicans on this question? Or do you see convergence on how to address income inequality among Democrats and Republicans?
What I do see right now is convergence, agreement that there is a problem of growing income inequality in the United States. I would have been, to be quite honest, quite surprised that both Republicans and Democrats recognize that this is a serious problem confronting the United States. You cannot address a problem unless you recognize that it exists. So that's the first step. I'm happy that we're there, and I'm hopeful that down the road there will be some sort of convergence or agreement on ways to deal with the problem that will have a real impact.
William Julius Wilson is a distinguished sociologist, author, and professor at Harvard University. Professor Wilson, thank you so much for your time and for your wonderful insights.
Thank you.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Gary Jaffe. And joining me on the program was VOA senior TV correspondent Chris Simpkins. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.